You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 375, Revelation 8, 1 through 6. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike. How you doing?
Well, not too bad. Yeah. I mean, it's rolling into, you know, NFL mode a little bit. You know, the draft now is history.
Yeah.
But we renewed the Naked Bible League, so it's kind of, you know, fantasy football is now on the radar, which I'm sure you'd rather hear that than any more fantasy baseball talk. So,
oh yeah, I'm sure you're
relieved.
No, yeah, I saw the email. I was excited.
Yeah. Well, if my team this year can stay out of the hospital, hopefully we'll be more competitive. But it's still a long way to go yet.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Anything else in the world going on, Mike? Really, nothing going on here.
Yeah, there's not much going on here. Although, at our recording day here, as we sit here, it's supposed to be 90 today in Jacksonville. So this is looking like the first realistic pool day, which means it's pug pool day or pug pool weekend. So I'll have to give you a report, or people will probably find out on Instagram if there's anything funny to report. Hopefully not tragic.
Is there any updates on the Ducks, on the War of the Ducks?
The Ducks have not been back for almost a week. Like when I brought that up, like a couple days later, they came back, and I actually had a video, of course, that Trina wanted me to delete, and I did, of her going after the Ducks.
Did you put snakes
they
up?
Have not been... No, we didn't even have to do that. You know, they just have not been back after she just literally charged at them. So maybe that was sufficiently terrifying. I don't know.
There you go.
But we haven't had Ducks for like 5 days, so not too bad.
What does that mean when we talk about the weather? I mean, does that mean we're old? Does that mean we have nothing to talk about? What does it mean when we talk about the weather?
Oh, I just think that, well, for on my end, it's like now we have clear, discrete seasons.
So it's fun to talk about. Yeah, I got you. I got you.
Even though it's sunny here all the time, okay, you know, you can actually sort of tell more about, you know, seasons, even though, yes, I know, in the fall we won't get snow and all that, so we're not really seasonal, but it's a lot better than just gray all the time. So we actually like talking about it right now, but we'll get tired of it.
Yeah, okay. No, that's fair enough. The new listeners, we just got to remind them that you moved from the Northwest.
Yeah.
So, you know, sunshine and palm trees.
We've got some, you know, at our house, you know, so they're just everywhere. Yeah. Yeah, it's not a novelty down here. They're just everywhere.
All right, Mike. Well, Revelation, we're doing the first six verses of Revelation 8.
Yeah, we can transition from talking about a little bit of paradise down here in Florida to the plagues of the apocalypse.
Exactly.
That's because that's what we get, you know, in Revelation 8. So, you know, this chapter is the beginning of the vision of the six trumpets. All right. And the sequence of those is kicked off in the first verse of Revelation 8:1, which is where the Lamb, you know, of course, who we know, you know, identified with that as Jesus, you know, according to Revelation 5 and 6 and so on. You know, it's kicked off by the Lamb's opening of the seventh and final seal on the scroll. So, you know, for those who are familiar with Revelation, or at least vaguely familiar, you know, you get this divine council scene in Revelation 4 and 5 that we spent a couple weeks talking about. And in the hand of God, who is seated on the throne, is this scroll. The scroll has seven seals on it. And we're actually going to return to the issue of the scroll isn't really opened until all of the seals are broken, because just think about it. You know, think about the real life equivalent or side of the metaphor. I mean, if you might have seven seals on the thing, but if six of them are off and the seventh is still there, you're still not able to open the scroll. That you know, might actually be a factor interpretively here in the sequence beginning. But once that last seal is broken, now we get six trumpets, and these are going to be judgments. Okay. At least that spill on into chapter nine. You're going to get a seventh later on, but again, for sort of a discrete unit, eight and nine sort of go together. They operate in tandem. So in the space of those two chapters, we're going to get these six, you know, trumpets, these judgments. And so we might as well just jump right in. I'm going to read the first six verses because that's really what we're going to cover today. And then next time we're going to hit the trumpet judgments themselves, because they have a very, at least the first four of them, have a very obvious overlap with the plagues, right, back in the Exodus story. So those six, you know, are going to be covered in the next episode. And so this is going to be sort of set up for that. But anybody who looks at the chapter is going to know that, boy, this sounds very obviously like the plagues on Egypt at the Exodus. And we'll get to that. And that's important because, again, we're focused on the use of the Old Testament when it comes to the content of Revelation. So let's just read the first six verses. Again, that's what we'll hit today. When the Lamb opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven for about half an hour. Then I saw the seven angels who stand before God, and seven trumpets were given to them. And another angel came and stood at the altar with a golden censer, and he was given much incense to offer with the prayers of all the saints on the golden altar before the throne. And the smoke of the incense with the prayers of the saints rose before God from the hand of the angel. Then the angel took the censer and filled it with fire from the altar and threw it on the earth. And there were peals of thunder, rumblings, flashes of lightning, and an earthquake. Now the seven angels who had the seven trumpets prepared to blow them. That's the end of the sixth verse. And of course, then that starts off the sequence. So the first thing we hit here is kind of obvious. There was silence in heaven. Like, what's that all about? There are actually several interpretive options for this, all of which have been offered by scholars, and they have, those scholars have proposed some connection with the Old Testament. So we're just going to hit the options real quickly here. There are several of these. Number one, Tonstad in his Revelation commentary. And this is a new resource that was actually recommended by a listener, and I went out and got it and have looked through it. It's actually got some really interesting things to say, because this is an author that actually recognizes divine counsel stuff in the book, which I think is why, you know, it was recommended to me specifically. But Tonstad in his Revelation commentary, it's part of the Paideia commentary series on the New Testament. Tonstad offers a couple of interpretations. The first one that he jumps into is that the silence is the silencing of prayers. And in this category, he writes in his commentary about R.H. Charles, you know, suggested this. And Charles, the quote from Charles's old Revelation commentary, and that name might be familiar to those who are into the Book of Enoch. It's the same guy, R.H. Charles. He spent a lot of time in the Book of Revelation, its apocalyptic literature, and the Book of Enoch, which is also apocalyptic literature. But Charles wrote, "The praises of the highest order of angels are hushed, that the prayers of all the suffering saints on earth may be heard before the throne," unquote. So again, this is just one option. And Tonstad, you know, again, goes through a few of these, and this is where I just, you know, decided to start. In this scenario, there's an enforced silence in heaven so that the prayers of the people suffering on earth don't get drowned out. Well, I mean, the text doesn't actually say that, but there you go. You know, Charles proposed this view in 1920. Again, you can find this sort of thing in apocalyptic literature. Certainly you find, you know, prayers both in terms of what's being done in heaven and on earth in the Book of Revelation. You find that. And again, this is just the way he takes the silence. So it's the silencing of prayers, because, you know, what else could there be going on that needs silencing? And so he opts for this, you know, the prayers that have been mentioned up to this point. Plus, he's going to associate it with the incense language, you know, because again, that was language used in the Old Testament to symbolize the ascent of prayers to heaven, you know, the burning of the incense and so on and so forth. So it's not like a far-fetched view or just a stab in the dark. It's just one of several, and that's where Charles was at, and so Tonstad mentions it. But Tonstad actually prefers a different option, which, you know, again, I don't know how how the audience is going to think about this. Again, we're just going through the options. This probably really wouldn't occur to anybody. And I have to be honest with you, I don't think this is that persuasive compared to some of the other options. But his own view, Tonstad's own view, number two, this is our second option, is that the silence is really about the lamb. That might sound a little weird, but here's how he puts it. He says, silence is the most striking feature of the Old Testament scene that has the greatest bearing on how best to understand the silence here in Revelation 8:1. And then he quotes Isaiah 52:14-15. And this is, I would assume this is his own translation. So those verses say, just as there were many who were astonished at him, this is the suffering servant, this is Isaiah 52 at the end, going on into Isaiah 53. Just as there were many who were astonished at him, so marred was his appearance beyond human semblance and his form beyond that of mortals. So he shall startle many nations. Kings shall shut their mouths because of him. For that which had not been told them, they shall see, and that which they had not heard, they shall contemplate. So he says, his argument is basically, look, Isaiah 52, these two verses, depict a silencing, the silence of shock and awe in the face of an unexpected discovery. Of course, in this case, it's the identity of the suffering servant. You know, so again, what's the cause of the silence back in Isaiah 52? They were astonished at him. And of course, this is the identity of the messianic servant who everybody thought was, you know, beaten and defeated and so on and so forth. Well, it turns out, no, not at all. And so he says, when this detail is applied to the mystery in Revelation, the cause for the silence will not be the events that are disclosed or the events still to be disclosed, whether the terrors of judgment or the prayers of the saints. He says, in fact, the silence is going to be due to the Lamb in the middle of the throne. When people, you know, when the people in the scene, or at least those who are causing the suffering, are awakened to the fact that the Lamb that was slain is now the holder of power, the Lamb in the midst of the throne. That's going to be the eye opener. He says, when human and cosmic reality is held up to what he is and what he reveals God to be, they are going to be at a loss for words. So again, this is his interpretation. I don't know that there's any real specific, other than the feature of shutting the mouth, there's really no textual connection between Revelation 8 back to Isaiah 52. But again, a lot of these are going to be like, they're going to be of like nature. There's going to be some loose sort of association. But again, just going through the options, this is where Tonstad lands and the one he prefers. Third option. On says that silence signals the eschatological return to primordial silence. In other words, the world shall be turned back to primeval silence for 7 days as it was at the first beginnings, at least according to, you know, some pseudepigraphical literature in 4th Ezra. The idea is that this is a reversion to the chaos that preceded the first creation. And again, if all this apocalyptic stuff, all this plague imagery is going to happen to the earth, it's as though the earth is being sort of taken apart. It's destroyed. It's Ragnarok, to borrow the Norse, you know, language that might be more familiar to listeners. Everything's going to get destroyed and decreated. And so that's the silence that is in view, at least, you know, On says, you know, this is worth considering. But then he's honest. He says the weakness of this view lies in the fact that the text says nothing about a reversion to the silence that preceded creation. So that, again, here you go. Yeah, on the one hand, you could take this trajectory. Oh, well, that makes sense. You know, an apocalypse decreates the earth. Oh, that sounds kind of good. But there's actually no specific textual hook back into like Genesis 1:2 or something like that. It's just sort of a supposition. It's an interpretive effort. So On is honest about that. But then he goes on and he actually has a different preference. He entertains that one for a while, and then where he lands would be number four for us. Silence must be maintained, he says, in the presence of God, particularly during certain phases of the liturgy. So what he's going to say is, look, we've got all this incense thing, we've got an altar reference, we've got prayers. And so he looks at Revelation 8 as being part of a liturgical process, a ritual liturgical process. And then he takes that back to the Old Testament and observes that in Psalm 62:1, Habakkuk 2:20, you have some Second Temple texts like the Epistle of Aristeus 95. You have priests in the Temple of Jerusalem do what they do in complete silence. Like that, like it's actually noted that priests were doing what they were doing, but they maintained quiet while they were doing it. And so Ohm draws attention to this kind of these kinds of references and says, well, we have some kind of ritual thing going on in Revelation 8. And so the silence is just there by those in the presence of God offering up the incense and, you know, burning it and all this sort of stuff. That's what the silence refers to. And interestingly enough, Malina lands here as well, just because of these Old Testament parallels. Ohm thinks this is the most convincing view because, quote, silence was very probably maintained during the incense offering in the Jerusalem temple cult. And then he quotes some rabbinic texts. He quotes the Testament of Adam 1:12 for that. So this is, again, where he lands. He sees the liturgy, and then he knows, again, enough of the literature to think that, hey, you know, just like when they were doing stuff in the temple, the priests would be silent. Similar things are happening here, and that must be the silence. Okay, so that's the fourth view. The fifth, and this is represented by Beale, and again, I'll be honest and just say I think this one just makes the most sense, or at the least, seems to hook more deeply and more securely back into the Old Testament. He says that silence is basically an appalled silence at the final judgment of the world. Now, what he means by this, it doesn't necessarily have to be a response to the judgment rendered, like after all these judgments play out. That's not when the silence happens. It doesn't happen after the judgments happen. It happens essentially when they become known, when the seventh seal is broken, and then these trumpets, you know, are at least the scroll is open, and you would be led to believe that when the scroll is open, that what ensues in chapter 8 and chapter 9 with these trumpet judgment, that's sort of the content of the scroll. When that becomes known, there's just this appalled silence at what's going to happen to the world. You know, there's just this shock. So Beale writes this. He says, silence is used in a mundane, non-theological manner, especially in contexts where someone has chosen not to speak. But the Old Testament also associates silence with divine judgment. Idolaters who die abide in silence, Psalm 115:17. Those who persecute God's people are judged by God and consequently sit in silence in Sheol, Psalm 31:17. There will be a primeval silence at the end of history. So Beale actually loops in the primeval idea here. When all the earth's inhabitants die immediately before the final judgment, then he gives us this 4 Ezra 7:30 quote, 4 Ezra 6:39, just like Ohm did when he discussed this. Beale continues and says, Babylon and Israel are silent because of God's judgment against them in Isaiah 47:5, Ezekiel 27:32, Amos 8:2 and 3, Lamentations 2:10 and 11. And likewise, in 1 Maccabees 1:3, quote, the earth was quiet before, you know, unquote, Alexander after he defeated his enemies. An overt eschatological hope is formulated whereby the wicked are silenced in darkness because the Lord will judge the ends of the earth. That's 1 Samuel 2:9 and 10. So you can see what this has some fairly obvious or fairly secure Old Testament roots. But Beale goes on and says, especially relevant are Habakkuk 2:20 and Zechariah 2:13, in which the Lord is pictured as being in his holy temple in heaven, and that's where he's at in the Revelation scene, from which he executes judgment on the ungodly, that is, on Babylon. In Habakkuk 2 and Zechariah 2, the context is Babylon. Of course, Babylon is going to become a factor later in the book of Revelation as the enemy. And so Beale is like, look, the setting's the same, you know, the name Babylon is used, you know, for the one upon whom God is going to take judgment and so on and so forth. So he sees sort of a clear path back to these two passages. And he continues and says that this temple is in heaven is to be assumed from other Old Testament texts, for example, Ezekiel 1 and Jewish apocalyptic texts, and is in fact evident from Habakkuk 3:3 through 6. And Zechariah 2:13 all the way to chapter 3, verse 2. The response or anticipated response to the judgment in these two texts is that, quote, all the earth and all flesh stand in silent awe. And then he has a couple cross references here, Isaiah 23:2 and Isaiah 41:1 through 5. Jewish commentators affirmed that the Song of Moses, which is Deuteronomy 32, which predominantly predicts the judgment of Israel because of idolatry, caused the whole creation to respond in silence. Let me just stop there. Now, again, those are Jewish commentators. Deuteronomy 32 doesn't say that, but it's kind of interesting that this gets looped in, you know, to the discussion by virtue of, you know, rabbinical thought about these other texts, about how judgment, you know, will produce this appalled silence. Okay. Back to Beale. He says, temple imagery is evoked again in Zephaniah 1:7, where people are to, quote, be silent, unquote, because God is about to slay them like a cultic sacrifice. Also Zephaniah 1:11, quote, all the people of Canaan will be silenced, unquote. These three announcements of judgment from the minor prophets are perceived by their writers as cosmic eschatological expectations, as implied by the pregnant word all. And then again, he has some other cross references. So he, you know, Beale winds up and says the silence in Revelation 8:1 is probably drawn from this Old Testament background. This means that it cannot be taken as emptiness, but it represents judgment or, you know, impending judgment. Yeah, that's the end of Beale. I think that makes sense. I think he marshals enough evidence to sort of take our minds that way. And when it plays out, it fits. Okay, I think it just does more justice to Old Testament context than some of these other views. And I kind of like the primordial element as well. So I appreciate that Beale brought that in. So again, let's loop in our earlier observation, which was from an earlier episode as well, that you don't really know what's in the scroll until the last seal is broken. Again, Owen had pointed that out earlier. And so the contents of the scroll can only be, you know, seen once this last seal is broken. And the contents of the scroll are essentially the rest of the book in terms of the judgment. So that's like Revelation 8:2 all the way through 22, verse 5. I mean, essentially, once this last seal is broken, we find out what's going to happen. It's the apocalypse, okay? It's the apocalypse. It's the day of the Lord judgment, you know, all this sort of stuff. And so, again, the silence happens before all that. So it's sort of revealed what God's actually going to do, and the horror of the judgment. That's what produces the silence, and to loop in the decreation idea that it's going to be returned to chaos, and then God's going to reorder it into a new Eden, just like He did in Genesis 1. Okay. That is the kind of mirroring and bookending that makes a lot of sense, at least to me. That, again, which is why I appreciate Beale bringing the primeval silence back in here. So there's no specific text that goes from 8:1 back into like Genesis 1:2. That's true, but the result, and again, if you look at Revelation 8:2 through 22:5, here's the decreation. Here's the descent back into chaos by virtue of God's judgment happening. And then what's left of the book is this recreation into a new Eden. Right? If you go back then and look at the first Eden, well, prior to that, you know, you do have this primeval chaos that God has to bring into order. So to me, it makes more conceptual sense than actually a specific text, you know, textual hook back into Genesis 1:2. And I think this is just, it's the most reasonable trajectory to me, again, to my eye. So I think this last option of Beale has a lot to commend it. And of the options, again, you know, I just think this is the best one to explain what's going on with the silence. Now you get to verse 2, and you get these seven angels, which are also mentioned in verse 6. So I saw the seven angels who stand before God, and seven trumpets were given to them. So the next question is, well, who are the seven angels? Now, what makes this interesting is in Second Temple Jewish literature, you get two kinds of listings of archangels. Sometimes there's seven, sometimes there's four. So it's not actually consistent. And so since you do get lists of seven archangels, commentators have been sort of inclined to see a connection there. Let me just jump into Beale and McDonough. This is from the Beale and Carson commentary on the Old Testament in the New Testament. And they write, the seven angels may be identified with the seven well-known archangels of Jewish apocalyptic. So you get them listed, for instance, in 1 Enoch 20, verses 1 through 8, Tobit 12, 15 is another. There's other places in 1 Enoch, 81, 5, 90, chapter 90, verses 21 and 22. Again, these are sort of well-known. And Beale and McDonough continue, they say, it is tempting to identify them, though, with the seven guardian angels of the seven churches in chapters 2 and 3. So that's the second option. Angels as divine agents executing the plagues follows the trajectory of biblical and Jewish tradition that angels were appointed by God to perform the judgments against the Egyptians, especially at the Red Sea. There are hints of this, and he cites Exodus 12, 23, and Psalm 78, 49 through 50, and then a few Targums at different Exodus passages. Targums are Aramaic translations that sort of insert the angelic idea. Personally, I again, this is where I'm going to land here. I don't think it makes much sense to align the angels here, the seven angels that are meeting out the judgment, with the guardian angels, the angel patrons of the seven churches in chapters 2 and 3. Because if you did that, that sort of makes it sound like the churches are somehow in the mix of meeting out or dispensing judgment, which is pretty contrary to what's going on in the book. I mean, the church is the one suffering. They're in no position to mete out judgment. I mean, God is, but they're not. So it doesn't really seem coherent, you know, to my ear and my eye. I think the seven, you know, points to the completeness of the judgment, the thoroughness of it. After all, it is the day of the Lord. Like there's not going to be anything left to do, you know, after this is over. It is a total decreation. I think the seven number helps to communicate that. And I do think there is something to the connection to the Exodus angelic agents being, again, agents of the plagues back in the Exodus story. I think that's the better trajectory in light of what follows, because the first four clearly resemble the plagues. Again, we'll hit that in the next episode. But let me just read Psalm 78, 49 through 50, just so you get an idea of what that passage is actually saying that Beale references here. In Psalm 78, again, this is sort of a reiteration of the history of Israel. I'm going to go all the way back to verse 42. So we're going to end up in 49 and 50, but here's verse 42, Psalm 78. They, the Israelites, did not remember his, you know, God's power, or the day when he redeemed them from the foe, when he performed his signs in Egypt and his marvels in the fields of Zoan. He turned their rivers to blood so that they could not drink of their streams. He sent among them swarms of flies, which devoured them, and frogs, which destroyed them. He gave their crops to the destroying locust and the fruit of their labor to the locust. He destroyed their vines with hail and their sycamores with frost. He gave over their cattle to the hail and their flocks to thunderbolts. Here's verse 49. He let loose on them his burning anger, wrath, indignation, and distress. A company of destroying angels. He made a path for his anger. He did not spare them from death, but he gave their lives over to the plague. But then in verse 51, it switches back to he, God, struck down every firstborn in Egypt. And I mention this because in my angels book, which I know some of you will have read, Psalm 78:49 does not say that destroying angels killed the firstborn. So we have a distinction here. The death of the firstborn, again, ironically, specifically, is accomplished by the Mashkit, the destroyer. And here in Psalm 78, it's God. And how can they be the same? Because the Mashkit, the destroyer, is the angel of the Lord. Again, this is what I discuss in my angels book. You know, 1 Chronicles 20. Again, there are passages where the angel of the Lord, who is God, in human form. There are passages where the angel of the Lord is a destroyer. He is the one who dispenses judgment, okay, in God's stead. And so you have these passages basically say two things. The destroyer, well, the destroyer is God, and the destroyer is this angel, and so on and so forth. So that's consistent theologically, again, in light of the two powers in heaven, the two Yahweh figures that I write about in Unseen Realm, and of course the book on angels and stuff like that. So we don't want to get that confused, the destroyer, singular, with destroying angels. Those are two different things, but they're related. The angels that are referenced in Psalm 78 are associated with enacting the plagues. So they become agents in some way of the judgment of the plagues. But the death of the firstborn is attributed to Yahweh as the angel. So again, I think Beal is picking the correct trajectory here, that the destroying angels here in the book of Revelation, especially since when you actually get into the trumpet judgments, mimic, at least the first four of them, mimic the plagues on Egypt. Okay, this is probably the best trajectory to go back to what happened in Egypt. And oh, in Psalm 78, when it's talking about what happened in Egypt, you have a company of destroying angels. And so we don't necessarily have to identify them as the specific seven archangels. Again, that terminology is not used. But I think the best way to understand this in light of the Old Testament is we have a company of destroying angels, just like we had in Egypt, and the number seven is used to denote the completeness of it, the utter decreation. Again, it is the day of the Lord after all. There's nothing left to do. Let's move on to 8:4, Revelation 8:4. Let's just pick up with verse 3. Another angel came and stood at the altar with a golden censer, and he was given much incense to offer the prayers of all the saints on the golden altar before the throne. Here's verse 4. And the smoke of the incense with the prayers of the saints rose before God from the hand of the angel. So we have reference here to the smoke of the incense with the prayers of the saints, which of course rose before God from the hand of the angel. Beal and McDonough write, prayer as incense in the Old Testament connotes a prayer accepted by God. That's Psalm 141, 1 and 2, Numbers 13, 18. Divine acceptance was also indicated by the fragrant, quote, smoke of incense, unquote, in the Old Testament temple. It's Leviticus 16, 12, and 13. In the Old Testament and the New Testament, incense was always associated with sacrifices. Incense was added to the burning of the sacrifice in order to make it acceptable to God, such as that on the Day of Atonement, for example, Leviticus 16, 11 to 19. You know, other references, Exodus 29, 18, Leviticus 2, 1 and 2. Revelation 8, 3 through 5 echoes Leviticus 16, 12 and 13 in the Septuagint, where we read the priest will, quote, take his censer full of coals of fire off the altar, which is before the Lord, and he will fill his hands with incense, and he will put the incense on the fire before the Lord, and the smoke of the incense will cover the mercy seat, unquote. Similarly, Exodus 30, verses 8 through 10, virtually equates incense with burnt offering and meal offering and links it directly with the Day of Atonement. The point here is, Beal and McDonough say, is that the Lord hears the prayers of his priestly people. Remember, who are the priests in the book of Revelation? They're believers. And the believers in the book of Revelation are the ones being martyred, the ones who are suffering. So the point here is that the Lord hears the prayers of his priestly people, just like using the Leviticus imagery for the Day of Atonement, connects those prayers with the prayers of these Old Testament figures, which God accepted. And back to Beal and McDonough. And the Lord answers with devastating judgment. Consequently, the Leviticus and Exodus portrayals serve as analogical precursors for Revelation 8:4. That's the end of their quote. But since the specific referent is the Day of Atonement, again, that's going to matter as well, because this, just think about the imagery. Think about the imagery, that we've just talked about. Hey, we've got, after Revelation 8, verse 2, really the rest of the book to Revelation 22, 5 is the content of the scroll. It's all this apocalyptic judgment stuff. So the world is going to be decreated, and then it's going to be recreated again into a new Eden, just like what happened in Genesis. There's a chaotic beginning, chaos. God brings order to the chaos. He produces a habitable world for humanity, and we get the garden in Eden. So we have this same same process going on. And what is the Day of Atonement for? If you think back to the Leviticus series, I used this analogy, which should be familiar to everyone. It's hitting the reset button. And if you remember the sacrifice that occurs the Day of Atonement, Aaron kills a bull because that's going to purge him of defilement, because he's going to have to enter into sacred space. And on this day, he even enters the Holy of Holies to sprinkle blood, you know, on the mercy seat. Because the two goats that are taken, the one that's sacrificed is never sprinkled upon Israelites or the people corporately. That blood is sprinkled upon the tabernacle, the objects, these holy objects, including the mercy seat. Why? It's to decontaminate them, to purge them, to essentially restore them to pristine condition as they were at the very beginning of the construction of all these objects when the worship, the whole Levitical system, was first created and instituted by God. The Day of Atonement is a reset button. And if you look at it that way, it makes sense to have the Day of Atonement specifically referenced here in Revelation 8, as if to say God has heard the prayers of the suffering his people. He is going to deal chaos a final death blow. This is the day of the Lord. The wicked are going to be decreated. In fact, the whole earth is going to be decreated. You know, all of those who are preserved through this, who will make it to the other side, the new Eden, are going to be the righteous. They're going to be the Lord's. Okay. Everyone else, this is their end. There's going to be everlasting life for the righteous and everlasting death for the unrighteous. Okay, there's a clear demarcation point. And when you emerge on the other side, you get to a new Eden. And it is as if, again, everything, it's as if there had been no fall, there had been no evil, there had been none of this stuff. It is a reset button. It is Eden as it was intended to be. And to use the imagery of the Day of Atonement trappings, you know, the ceremony there, would be a good conceptual way of communicating the point of the reset. Everything is going to be decreated. Yes, it's going to be awful. It's so horrifying that there's silence in heaven. But on the other side, everything is going to be restored and renewed to what God originally wanted it to be. And so these hooks back into these Old Testament themes, and in some cases, specific passages, whether it's Exodus or Leviticus or whatever, are important for communicating ideas. Even the company of destroying angels, that takes people's minds back to the plagues in Egypt, which were a precursor to what? To deliverance of the people of God. You know, taking them to, it was the initial stage of arriving at and in the promised land, okay? So all these themes are important, again, to sort of cast what's going to happen in imagery associated with the judgment of the gods of Egypt. Okay, that was the major force of chaos in the life of God's people. It was Egypt, because God's people were living where? In Egypt, okay? The descendants of Abraham are in Egypt. And so chaos and the gods, you know, that create it, that help create it, is destroyed. They're dealt with. They are judged. And then God's people are delivered. Again, so that's one set of images. The other set of images, the Day of Atonement, the reset button. Okay, all these things are important to sort of help communicate ideas about what's being revealed in the book. So that brings us to 8:5, and this will be the last verse I comment on for this episode. We have, then the angel took the censer and filled it with fire from the altar and threw it on the earth, and there were peals of thunder, rumblings, flashes of lightning, and an earthquake. Now that language ought to be familiar. Beale and McDonough again write, this is the last judgment. The fire results in thunders and sounds and lightnings and quakings, which is an almost identical expression for a description of consummate judgment later in the book, in Revelation 11:19 and Revelation 16:18. The fourfold metaphorical chain of cosmic disturbance has a precedent in the Old Testament where it also refers to divine judgment. And look at the passages, Exodus 19:16 and 18, Psalm 77:17 and 18, Isaiah 29:6. Okay, Exodus 19 ought to be ringing bells with Sinai. I mean, we've seen this language before in association with the presence of God, you know, God showing up at Sinai. Beale and McDonough continue, since the formulaic phrase concludes the series of trumpets and bowls by referring to the last judgment, the same formula here likewise must conclude the series of seals. What that means is, let me just stop there. those later references in Revelation, Revelation 11, 19, 16, 18, you're going to see the same language wrap up the series of trumpets and the series of bowls. It's going to sound the same way. So what Beal and McDonough are saying, it's here because it concludes the series of seals. So when the seals are done, you get this thunder, lightning, quaking, you know, language. When the next series is done, you're going to see it again. When the third series is done, you're going to see it again. So back to Beal and McDonough. The Sinai theophany of Exodus 19, 16 to 18 is partly in mind in 8:5, since it was part of the allusion, if not the primary one, earlier in Revelation 4:5, which we've talked about quite a bit in those episodes. The virtually identical phrases in Revelation 4:5, 8:5, 11:19, 16:18 to 21 are all Sinai allusions. And so, again, Beal and McDonough comment, the portrayal of Revelation 8, 3 to 5 is also modeled to a great extent on that passage and also looping in Ezekiel 10, 1 through 7. Ezekiel 10, 1 through 7 is important because there we get an angelic figure standing in the heavenly temple and is told, fill your hands with coals of fire from between the cherubim, presumably from the altar, and scatter them over the city of Jerusalem. This comes immediately after the narrative of Ezekiel 9, in which the angels were commanded to slay all the unfaithful in Jerusalem, upon whose foreheads God's angel did not place a protective mark. And we've been through some of that before when we talked about Revelation 4, so we're not going to rehearse that here. But again, you get the same feel. You've got Day of the Lord imagery. You've got it married to Sinai imagery because this is a way to communicate the presence of God, the wrath of God, you know, God being, you know, the agent, you know, behind all this. It's God seated on his throne. In Sinai, it's on the mountain. Okay. Here it's the heavenly temple. It's the heavenly abode. Back at Sinai, it was this earthly abode on this particular mountain. Okay. So this is, you know, John again, it wants to communicate all of these ideas. The deliverance of his people. Okay, preceded by the judgment, you know, of the gods of Egypt, the judgment of chaos, and so on and so forth, the deliverance of his people, you know, they're coming to again a place. In the Old Testament, they wind up at Sinai, and God makes a covenant with them with this same Sinai imagery, you know, the thundering and the lightning and the quaking and all that stuff. But God is not their enemy. God is the one who loves them and enters into a covenant with them. I mean, that people are scared because, you know, we've covered this in the Book of Exodus series as well, but they actually enter into a covenant there. And here, by looping this in, it's like, okay, God's remembering his covenant. He has heard the prayers of his people. He's going to do it all over again. He's going to judge, you know, the agents of chaos, whether they're human or supernatural. He's going to decreate everything, but he's also going to recreate it. He will remember his covenant. He will remember those who are his, and they will emerge once the reset button is hit on the other side in the new Eden. Again, this is really Revelation 8, 1 through 5, 1 through 6, kind of sets up not only the decreation stuff from, you know, this point on to early in Revelation 22, but it also sort of sets up what follows, you know, that when you get the vision of the new Jerusalem, the new Eden, you know, the global Eden, all this, the new earth. It sets up all this stuff thematically. And so this is a good place, again, to stop, because next time we'll take a specific look at the plagues and their similarities to what's going on in Egypt. And then, again, there are a couple of these judgments, the trumpet judgments. Again, the first four are these, essentially the plagues of Egypt all over again. But there are others that are different, again, that take us into more, if I can dare say it, more supernatural territory. So what you get is the first four trumpets are going to be modeled on the Exodus plagues against Egypt. In essence, they're a reenactment. It's what was done to Egypt all over again. Plus, that helps us see sort of a new Exodus deliverance for the people of God. They're the ones that are going to survive on the other side. The righteous are vindicated the day of the Lord. But chapter 9's fifth trumpet, believe it or not, is oriented by the fall of Hillel ben Shakar. Okay, the shining one. You know, the Lucifer figure, okay, if you will. There are connections to that one in the fifth trumpet. and also the judgment of the watchers in the abyss. That happens in Revelation 9 too, in conjunction with these judgments. There's a lot of demonic imagery in the last two. Let's just put it that way. A lot of, you know, supernatural cosmic powers of darkness imagery in the last two. So that's what we're going to hit next time. We'll go through all six of them that occur in these two chapters. And again, hopefully by listening to this, you know, introductory part, you can kind of see where things are going to go and the logic of what parts of the Old Testament are sort of brought into play to help us sort of understand what's going to follow and really help the reader understand, you know, what's going to emerge on the other side of basically the world being annihilated. I mean, because that's what the apocalypse is. That's what the day of the Lord is. So it sort of sets up what God is doing. It's not random destruction. The apocalypse itself, the decreation itself has a goal. Okay. Things are going to get reset. And again, that's what's going to play out in the rest of the book.
All right, Mike, looking forward to part two, if you will, I guess 8 and 9, the trumpets. Can you imagine if the trumpets were actually like a saxophone? Does that make it scarier or?
Gosh, that doesn't really strike me as a scary instrument.
Yeah.
Unless I was playing it, then it would.
I should have saved that joke for next week.
But horrific.
Maybe I'll bring it back.
Well,
since I played the saxophone, that's why I bring it up. Okay. So, but, all right, Mike, good stuff. Looking forward to it next week. And with that, I want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.